so I am here once again with Richard Russo, who is most recently the author of That Old Cape Magic. Rick, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. A little hot. How about you?
I think it is a little hot. I must ask you if you have, in your life, encountered a sign with unusual spacing, like the one that forms the codex problem in this particular book. where does a sign like this come from? You've seen a sign like this?
I'll tell you exactly where it comes from. It comes from a restaurant North Falmouth.
Yeah.
Called the Silver Lounge.
Uh-huh.
Which is, I've altered its appearance a little bit for the purposes of narrative, but that sign actually sits there.
Yeah.
And I called my wife and I had been to the restaurant a couple of times, and I'd always smiled at it, worked my way through it, but I knew I wanted, and then I wanted to use it for this book, and I actually called the owner one day, and we talked on the phone for about 15 or 20 minutes. First of all, telling me what it said, but also just talking me through where the spaces were, because I had to replicate it in my in my
How
book.
How close is the saying in the book to the saying that's in that on that particular
Identical.
Sign? Identical?
Yes.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
I don't know where it came from. I don't think it's original to that restaurant. But I also haven't seen it anywhere else, so I don't know.
Likewise, I must ask you about your driving habits, given that driving is a problem for the Griffin men here. So personal experience with the sort of bungee trunk?
When I was younger, I did have I got into more accidents in like Kmart parking lots than anywhere else on the road. Once I was on the road heading forward, I was fine.
Yeah.
But I did for a while there. I had like three or four or five of those rear end collisions where you're backing out, somebody else is backing out, and you're also doing a loop. They're doing a loop towards you. You're doing a loop back, and you kind of meet in the center, not directly, but making that loop. I had four or five of those in a row.
Yeah.
And my father was a horrible driver. He was always having accidents.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, there is some autobiography in the male line of the Griffin family.
Well, this begs the question, and we kind of got into it last time we talked about how much you draw from reality versus how much you invent. I mean, obviously, Griffin and you are totally different.
I wouldn't say totally, but we're quite different.
Yeah. But I mean, at what point does something that you take, a real-life incident, must it be adapted or transmuted to a certain degree before it becomes fiction? Can it be taken wholesale and placed
like,
or juxtaposed?
Like I took that sign.
Exactly.
Well, I couldn't improve upon the sign. Usually what happens is that when I see something that interests me and I decide to make use of it, usually it's not complete in a way that I can use it until I've altered something. So I find it usually, that sign was a gift, but you don't get many gifts like that. Usually you have to alter something.
Yeah.
In order to make it really fit the slot that you have for it.
Yeah.
So in this case, I gave I wanted for a man like Griffin's father who lives in his head a lot, I wanted him to not navigate. I think I wanted him to not navigate the world without collision. You know.
Yeah.
So I was looking. I was looking for something that I could use along those lines.
The name Griffin. Were you thinking Merv Griffin, or were you thinking more mythological?
Merv Griffin. Griffin Dunn. I don't know. I don't know where that name came from. And originally, I think I thought of it as his first name.
Huh.
Yeah.
That explains why Jack is only mentioned once.
That's right.
In the course of the book, he's constantly referring to him.
That's right. Huh. And I remember when I turned the book into my editor, there was some confusion about whether his name was Griffin something, if so, what?
Yeah.
Or Jack Griffin. And I went back and I put his first name in the first sentence. Yeah. Just to clarify that. Yep.
On the record, Bon Jovi's Living on a Prayer. Why Living on a Prayer over You Give Love a Bad Name? Or was Living on a Prayer the tune that was more applicable to weddings?
Ed, you're trying to make me feel regret now, aren't you? Because that would have been perfect as well.
Yeah.
Or was it
more about living than love? The emphasis of the book.
It was the result of my wife and I having gone recently to a number of weddings and being absolutely fascinated by the way young people my daughter's age react to that song, because it is so much, it is so much before their time, and for a lot of, for a lot of young people, 28, 29, 30, it is a kind of anthem. And the way they not only know the words, but they have a kind of, they have a kind of routine worked out on the dance floor. Those in the know have this routine on the dance floor that involves the fist pumping, which they do in unison. You know, sometimes 40 or 50 of them, young people out on the dance floor, to a song that is just so much before their time. But they've, but they've adopted it. So it was. It was a wonderful way to show a bridge between those generations, and Laura, who does such a kind act in that scene that kind of redeems him, that kind of redeems her father, at least temporarily. It just fit that slot so nicely, and it also suggests that I think that when Griffin begins this novel, his life, for the most part, seems, he's had a tiff with his wife, but it's really only just a tiff. I mean, he has a kind of tenure in his job. He loves his life. He loves his wife. He loves his daughter. Everything is right, and yet by the end of the first half of the book, he's living on a prayer.
Yeah.
And he knows it.
Yeah.
Whereas he didn't in the beginning.
But it's interesting because your timing is absolutely perfect. Because recently on YouTube, there's this video that's been going around. There's 18 million people have seen of this elaborate dance at a wedding, the whole set of music.
Oh, there's, I
haven't, in fact,
seen it.
Well, I know, I don't think you're much an online guy. I wanted to talk about the notion of the home in this book. There's a sentiment that is expressed, you aren't a real adult until you have a mortgage you can't afford. Griffin is pressured into homeownership, and he and his wife often sift through the real estate catalogs, splitting up the properties into can't afford it and wouldn't have it as a gift.
Right.
And then also, 13-year-old Sonny Kim says, you have a lovely home,
right,
later on in the book. So home, though, is not necessarily where the heart is in this. This is a couple that is united by the idea of home as a piece of property, as opposed to a place where one can establish a family. This is a couple that settles on the great Truro Accord and actually figures that this prearranged stratagem will be able to aid them in deflecting every curveball of life thrown their way. So I wanted to just ask you why the home of all things would be the center place, or even just property in general, would be the center place for this couple's failure to, number one, deal with life, and number two, come to the real terms that, you know, they are their parents and that, you know, they share a lot of family qualities in life. That's a lot of points. I'll stop there.
I'm overwhelmed by the question. the other conflict, of course, is that in Griffin's parents, of course, are confirmed renters.
Yeah,
their notion of a home is something that recedes before them, like the Cape itself. I mean, home for them is a place that you can only visit, and so for Griffin, home is something that he is really reluctant to go to. Joy loves her parents' home. She loves the parents' home. She loves the vacation home, the same home that they rent every year. For her, home is a central place, as you said. It is the place where love resides most powerfully. And I think I would also expand that to say that home, like marriage, is not just a private thing. It's just as marriage kind of institutionalizes love in some way, home kind of institutionalizes family. So when Sonny Kim, the outsider, comes in and says, you have a lovely home, he's saying, you have a lovely daughter with whom I'm in love. You have a lovely marriage to which I aspire. You have a lovely home that I would like to live in one day, and you have a lovely nation that is now my adopted home. So,
but he doesn't
just
say,
as your question is big, your question is big, my answer is kind of big too in that sense that the notion of home by the time we get to the end of this book, especially that final Sonny Kim scene.
Yeah.
That notion of home has gone from something at the beginning. It was two people separating real estate property on a place they can't afford into those two categories. Can't afford it and wouldn't have it as a gift.
Yeah.
And now and by the time we get to the end of the novel, it's almost something that you would expect to be taken over at some point by Department of Homeland Security.
Home there. Yeah. But this is interesting because he doesn't say you have a lovely family, which he could still get away with saying that and hide his feelings for the daughter.
Right.
So this is why I ask. I mean, if home is a schematic, much like the constant narrative that Griffin is seeking throughout the book. For example, he has the story that he carries with his student portfolios.
Right.
The Summer of the Brownies.
The Summer of the Brownies,
and
right.
He also has, when he's trying to think of what occurred in the second wedding, which I don't want to reveal,
right.
He's thinking in terms of screenplay narratives.
Right.
So he has to think, he can only approach things in the form of a schematic or a narrative instead of actually just being honest about feelings and the like. That's why I asked this question about this home
schematic. And Griffin does, you're right, I think Griffin does live very schematically in that respect.
Okay, let's go to an actual question instead of an observation. I wanted to talk about the constant cantilevered environments that you have throughout this book that often reflect the cape itself, which is, of course, jutting off. You have the father-in-law near the top of a long, sloping wheelchair ramp. And, of course, that ends up falling off in an entirely unanticipated way. You have a summer vacation home that has floors so pitched that if you dropped a Parcheesi marble off the kitchen table, you'd end up chasing it around the living room. And, of course, there's the hedge maze where Griffin and his daughter have their little talk. There's a greater emphasis with the nature of environment, meaning this kind of sloped quality as opposed to what is actually in the environment. I wanted to ask you about this.
God, you've read this really carefully. Thank
you.
We
have a lot in here. So,
I hadn't thought about that in terms of the sloped porches and the it hadn't occurred to me that now that you mention it, this is a book about a man in a kind of downhill spiral, isn't it? Yeah, he's kind of lost his bearings, and now that you mention it, I'm thinking of other cantilevered objects, the Sagamore Bridge, the Sagamore Bridge, the way that sentence is written, now it comes flying back to me that you've mentioned this metaphor, is that the cantilevered bridge, when he goes up on top of the bridge, it's the bridge that causes the sun to rise.
Yeah.
The way he observes it, because the sun is below the horizon, only when he gets to the top of the bridge yanks the sun above the horizon. Right, so there again is Griffin in his schematic, and these sloped things, and he goes down the other side of the Sagamore Bridge. Suddenly, in the past, he's on the downslope of the past. All the memories that he would just as soon forget come flooding back to him, including the Summer of the Brownings story, and all of that is the result of these various. Slopes, things that will not stay level, things that should be level and will not stay level.
But the question is how much is an environment like this planned? It does repeat very often this. I could also mention the interesting cradle to the grave metaphor that you have in Griffin's car, because you have the cell phone with the mother constantly calling Griffin that is cradled in the cup holder, as you use deliberately the words cradled.
Yep.
And of course, you have the urn in the trunk, so cradled the grave. There you go.
Yep.
So I could go on like
in the wheel well.
Yep. So I mean, how,
which is another cradle.
How much? Yep. Yeah, there you go. Well, how much of this is deliberate on your part?
I would have to be honest with you, Ed, and say almost none of it. I think every now and I don't think a writer, certainly not this writer. I don't think a writer most of the time is smart enough. To figure this out, what you have to be is smart enough to recognize it. And sometimes that means that you're saying to yourself, okay, I'm working on a metaphor here, and let's see how I can make these things line up. Other times it just feels right. But usually the last step of revision is for me to say, okay, now the book is complete in the sense that I know how the story ends. I know its principal themes. I know the way the characters have been moving about the book, the way I'm moving them about the book. So at this point, I say to myself, okay, what are the central images? What are the central metaphors? What are the things that seem to be working here? And then go back through the book again and see if you can make all those ducks face in the same direction. So I think that many people would think that's one of the first thing that you would do. You would figure out the structure, the schematic, the plan for all of that. And usually what happens with me is almost the opposite. I look to see what I've done, and then especially what's working well, and then say, all right, now why is this working well? And then try to find other ways that I can, in the next scene, do something that echoes that, imitates it, reinforces the image. But it's pretty close to the end before I really know what I've done. So I can't make all the ducks face the same direction until I'm clear what the direction is. So that comes fairly late, actually.
But this is interesting because does this occur at the end of the book? You go back and see what subconscious metaphors you have placed in there? Because this is interesting in light of the scenario we discussed last time with Bridge of Sighs that also occurred with this book, which started off as a short story and then just grew and grew and mushroomed.
Yep.
And your powers of invention or whatnot just became almost unwieldy. It's what you anticipated before as one turned into three books, which turned into a mammoth book. This is a short story that turned into another book. Right. I mean, at some point during the initial process of creation, you, how do you stop yourself? And how do you plan for that inevitable moment when you have to go back and see how the ducks, so to speak, are lined up?
Right. In this particular book, which did exactly as you described it, it started out as a short story. This is one of the more mysterious things that happen to writers, I think, is that we have a mechanism that I don't think we have complete access to all of the time. The reason I wanted to write a short story was that Bridge of Sighs, that massive mammoth undertaking, had left me really drained. And I thought that I didn't have the strength right then, the emotional strength, the emotional wherewithal to begin a new novel. And I think what happened was that there was this thing, there was this novel, and I managed to trick myself somehow, subconsciously. I managed to trick myself into writing a short story, which I thought I could handle. I think subconsciously I tricked myself into thinking that the thing was small. By the time I realized it was bigger than I had dreamed, I wasn't as tired anymore. Several things had happened in my life. Number one, I had already written the 40 or 50 pages that convinced me that it wasn't a short story and gotten some momentum going. I mean, you always... If you're a novelist in particular, the most dangerous time is right at the beginning because you think to yourself, where am I ever going to find the strength to do this?
Yeah.
You know? If you can get the beast moving, if you can just somehow or other get a little forward momentum, then that sense of exhaustion kind of goes away. Now, when I got Griffin, the original idea of the story was that I would have Jack Griffin, who's had a tiff with his wife. He's headed to a wedding, and I thought we'll never get to the wedding. That's the idea, is that he thinks he's going to a wedding. What's really going to happen to him is that he's going to take his father's ashes out to scatter them, and he's either going to scatter those ashes, something that he thought he might need his wife to help him to do. He's either going to scatter the ashes and realize that number one, that he didn't need his wife's help to scatter the ashes, and then that would blow open the whole possibility that he didn't need his wife.
Sure.
Right? Yeah. Or he would discover that he couldn't scatter the ashes and that he did need his wife. And so you'd have either an unhappy ending or a happy ending. But basically, it was going to the length of the short story was going to be Griffin leaving Boston, driving out to the Cape, either scattering the ashes or failing to, and we would never go to the wedding.
But you have two weddings.
That's right.
You have many twins in this book, as a matter of fact.
That's
You've
right.
You've got family where everybody's first name begins with a J, which is, even for you, that's pretty damn quirky, I gotta say. But you also have the lesbians from Where are they from? Oh, yeah, Liverpool.
Liverpool, yeah.
And you also have, of course, the twin brothers. I mean,
Jared
twins,
and Jason.
Twins. I mean, and we've done twins before, but this is... I mean,
there's lots
I'm thinking
of, there's
Head
lots
Wilson
of,
twins here.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Yeah, so
that's
what,
right. There's lots of twinning.
Yeah.
There's lots of twinning going on in this book. Yeah.
Is twinning just part of this process of anticipation of the momentum that you're describing here? Or?
Possibly. Possibly. I don't know where all those twins came from, but I was delighted by every one of them. Jason and Jared steal every scene they're in. I just loved watching their antics. The lesbian lovers from the first Table 17 party. They're all sorts of twins going on. I wish I could explain it to you.
No. Well, let's go back to this question of momentum. I mean, it seems to me that when you devise the schematic in your head of the short story, that you didn't really know how it would turn out, even though you knew how it would turn out. Therefore, there's this element of surprise.
Yeah.
I venture to put forth to you, and maybe you could describe that your writing and your rewriting are motivated possibly by surprise, in the sense that you want to find out how it turns out, and then when you go back there, you see the surprise of your metaphors lining up the ducks. Is that really how the things go here for the?
I think that's a very astute observation. I think that that's pretty much the way it works. I am a writer who's in it for the surprise. I don't like to know too much. I did not anticipate that his mother would call on the phone. I did not anticipate that the seagull would crap on Griffin when he's there taking his mother's call. But the real surprise in all of that, and the thing that made it a novel and not a short story, was the fact that Griffin blamed his mother for the bird.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because that's the kind of leap, that's the kind of surprising leap where, and talk about momentum. When that happened, it was up to that point, I had been moving along at a nice pace. I was enjoying myself, but it was like the lid just got blown off the top of the thing. And suddenly I thought, of course we're going to the wedding. Of course, why did I think we weren't going to the wedding? And then I remembered that my wife and I had gone to a wedding where we had been sat at a table 17, where nobody knew it. We were seated directly beneath the speaker or the DJ, you know? And so once that happened, once the lid got blown off, then suddenly where I was poking along in the breakdown lane, Not only am I going 100 miles an hour, I suddenly have the energy now that I didn't have at the beginning, where the very idea of starting a novel at that point, that I was so low, so emotionally exhausted, so much still in Lucy Lynch's world of despair from the earlier book. Now I'm going 100 miles an hour, and I'm feeling good, and the idea of a novel is of course I'm writing a novel. I'm a novelist.
Yeah,
you know.
But this scenario with the seagull shit.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
I should point out that immediately after that, you have Griffin hit by a droplet of water. Now I'm curious, hearing
Wait a
how
second,
you,
Griffin is hit
by the rain.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
So I'm wondering if a symmetry like that, of things falling from the sky, does
oh
that
my
come?
God.
Just,
now we're I, now we're back to
this
twins.
This was not a duck lining up in a row.
Okay.
That answers my question.
I couldn't explain the twinning, and now I got to explain the rain. Oh my God.
No, but I mean, my question is like, you know, how aware? I mean, that to me seemed to me, based on what you described, like, well, that's probably something of the ducks lining up in a row.
Yeah.
But
yes.
maybe you
yes.
could. But so that was
yes.
then for you. Okay. So that
yes.
was a conscious decision. The rain came in a revision as opposed to writing, or
now is this the rain outside the restaurant when Griffin is caught in the in the downpour and he's wondering what's next, frogs?
Yes. Okay.
No, the original draft, he simply left the restaurant and went back to his motel room, and then it's the next day and they go to the wedding. But then, somewhere along the second or third draft, then I started working the agent into it. And But Marguerite was there, the cause of all of this, the emotional center of all of this. Marguerite was there at the beginning, and he just, when Griffin leaves the restaurant at the beginning, he was thinking about punching that guy out, the guy was with her, and he does it. He just goes home. But once I brought the agent into it, and we learned that his agent, not only has his agent died, but that he's not going to, that life he was thinking about returning is probably no longer available to him. Then he gets to consider all manner of different kinds of grief, and it all comes together. And of course, with that much grief,
you've suddenly
everything is falling from the sky.
I'm curious, whose tears came first, Marguerite's or Joy's? Who did you decide to cry first?
Which of those women?
Well, because there's a scene, and there's in the
That's
bar.
Right.
Marguerite, you know, he can see that she's crying when they have to eat at the bar.
Right.
And then Joy,
right.
we later learn, we see that she's actually crying.
Marguerite's tears came first. I do remember that. Uh-huh. But I think what happened was that Marguerite's grief, which he has just a small window into, opened up the subject of women's grief in general.
Yeah.
The grief of women that they hide from men suddenly then became very important, and I realized that I needed that, the twin of that Marguerite scene.
Interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
There's one thing I also wanted to ask you about the close third person in this, which some reviewers in Newsweek have decided to interpret to be, oh well, Richard Russo's a misogynist.
Yeah.
Two questions that come about, and actually I have a couple of other questions in relation to the actual narration. Mm-hmm. But do you think right now that we're in a sort of publishing environment in which if you write a book that focuses on men, I mean, never mind that there are many clear instances of the woman controlling the men in this book, that they are actually in charge and that the men are essentially powerless with these women. Mm-hmm. Do you think that we're seeing, why do you think we're seeing such charges, particularly leveled at you, of all people? I mean, do you think that there is a certain kind of hostility in the critical air towards relationships in books or life explored in books in a male-centric narrative like this? I mean, why do you think that this has occurred right now? Have you seen anything like this? I don't think anybody's ever called you a misogynist before.
No. I mean, it's in my early novels. I think reviewers sometimes pointed out my early novels, Mohawk, especially The Risk Pool and Nobody's Fool, were very male-oriented. They were father-son stories. And I think reviewers said, all right, when are we going to get some women from Richard Russo novels that are as strong as his male characters? A lot of that went away with Straight Man and with Empire Falls, and even to a certain extent with Nobody's Fool because of Miss Burrell and Nobody's Fool. And then we got Tick Robey and Janine in Empire Falls, and of course Sarah in Bridge of Sighs, and that my one of my favorite characters, that wonderful nun in The Horse Child. Yeah. So a lot of that went away. I have a feeling that what happens in close third person is, especially when you have a character who shares a number of characteristics with the author, because Griffin is a teacher. I was a teacher. He's roughly the same age as I am, and he's a former screenwriter. I've written screenplays. There are a number of correspondences there that would encourage that kind of reading. Oh, it must be this must. This Jack Griffin is really just a foil for Richard Russo. There is that, but there's also I think there's something else going on, and it goes right to the heart of what literature is and does, and it poses particular problems for moralists, people who maybe don't even really like literature that much, but are driven by certain moral prerequisites. I think, for instance, if you write a story about a misogynist, which I did in the story that particularly that was the Monhegan Light story that this particular reviewer took real offense at. I think when you write a story about a misogynist, someone who is, Martin is in that book, I think essentially, maybe a fool seems too strong a word, but he's certainly made foolish choices. He has not seen the beauty in his own wife, and he goes to Monhegan Island asking a painter. He himself is a cinematographer, and he's asking this painter, "How could you see her in this light?"
Yeah,
you know, that allowed. How did you? In other words, how did you see her beauty when I missed it?
Yeah.
And the story ends with him realizing that he's probably going to sell this other woman that he's with now short for the same reason, because he cannot see what is true. Right, so in that sense, he is kind of a fool. But what causes people who have fundamental problems with literature problems in that story is that I have invested in this fool a great deal of sympathy. I think literature is allowed to do that, and I think writers are allowed to do that. I think that I have a great fondness for all manner of fools. I think that, for instance, that's the second story in the book. The first story, strangely enough, about that 84-year-old nun, is a similar story in the sense that this is about a woman who's made a tragic mistake in her life by not being able to see the truth of a circumstance. She has always believed that her father loved her and that her mother, the prostitute, did not. So she has been, in a sense, a fool, and in a sense, a misogynist herself, because her beloved father, she believes has given her all these gifts. Her mother doesn't give her anything, but of course the father is spending the mother's money. The father is the mother's pimp. And so she has lived the life of a fool by not being able to face the truth of her circumstance, just as Martin has earlier on. Now, I think that the reviewer who harbors suspicions about me as a misogynist would have a hard time with that second story. She wouldn't see that second story that way. She would think that I was perfectly right to invest a lot of sympathy in that nun. And she would say that she deserves that sympathy because look at her life. Look at how tragic her life has been.
Yeah.
Whereas she cannot extend that same sympathy to Martin, who I think has been no more a fool than Sister Ursula, because she's made that one-to-one connection between... Well, obviously, you're not with an 84-year-old nun. You're not going to say, "Well, that's obviously the author," author Richard Russo. But still, I think that's what it is. I think that literature demands of us that we look at somebody sometimes who behaves badly, and we invest sympathy in them. It's just a very, very basic thing, and some people don't want us to do that.
Yeah,
they really don't.
I wonder if it's this. That close third-person narrative causes a certain level of authenticity, meaning that you're somehow going to try to find the source of that, meaning it would be author, therefore charges along these lines go directly to the author. But actually, this raises a number of interesting dilemmas.
More than first person, do you think?
To some degree, more than first person, because there's a sort of removal. By way of it not being a perspective, you think that it's the author's sympathies in the actual close third person. And maybe, you know, we've seen in the last 10 years a lot of talk about whether a memoir is based on a true story, whether it's real,
right,
whether it's
right,
a lie
right,
and all that.
Right.
So maybe this may be a result of that too. But this leads me to believe, because I actually did want to ask you about Sonny Kim, because it faces Sonny Kim's character, and I interpreted it this way. Essentially, he has a lot of stereotypical qualities. And in fact, if...
The hardworking Asian.
Yeah. He goes to Stanford. Mm-hmm. He is very pro-family and all that. And I don't think that you necessarily believe that Koreans are like that. But I can believe that Griffin does, because first of all, this is a guy who really is very interested in his daughter. Mm-hmm. So we have a risk here, and I'm wondering if this problem, this interpretive problem, is something that, you know, that concerns you or that we should all be concerned about. Because if we can't have sympathy of someone who's flawed like this, how then can we have truth in novels, you know?
Oh, I absolutely agree. But now that you've raised the question, I'm curious. If you go back to a writer like Poe, who always wrote those stories about madmen and murderers, and always used the first person,
Yeah. That
encouraged an awful lot of people to believe that Poe must have been insane himself. But that's a 19th century. Yeah. That's a 19th century writer. What you're suggesting now is that in some ways, if I had written Monhegan Light and I hadn't called the character Martin, if I had said I,
yes,
in some ways, I would have been. By that, by putting that identification out there in the first person, I'd actually be creating distance, whereas in third person, giving the character a different name from mine, I'm hiding, I am, as an author, then hiding just how much, or I'm trying to hide.
Yes.
Just how much alike we are.
Because the reader
accepts. That's fascinating.
This is, I think, related to your particular writing, which is a little bit more straightforward.
Okay.
At
first, I didn't understand what you were getting to.
Is what I think the conundrum is. I'm trying to figure this out and see what your thoughts are on this. Because people accept that, because you have so many truths and specific behavioral observations in your work, you therefore must be a man in the know, and that therefore you must simultaneously advocate the actions of the characters in some sense.
Right.
But if you had said, you know, I Hank Devereaux, or I so-and-so, actually you did say I Hank Devereaux,
yep.
I'm sorry,
yep.
Then people would say, oh, it's the character's perspective, it's not necessarily Rousseau. I mean, no one's going to call you a misogynist for straight man. That's my theory here, you know?
Right, right, right. I think you've just convinced me to write my next book in the first person.
Yeah. But I mean, why, maybe we could talk about why you choose to do a first person versus a third person. Why does it carry, why in this case did you go third person instead of first? I'm just out of curiosity. What are the determining factors for a decision like that?
You know, an awful lot of it is impulse from the start. Usually, what I used to tell my students back when I was teaching was that if a character that you're writing about is really similar to you, the closer the character is to you autobiographically, the details of the character's life, the closer they match up to your own, the better off you would be to tell the story in third person.
Yeah.
Because something about giving the character a name other than yours and referring to him as if he were someone not you gives you as an artist a little bit more distance, and probably that's what you need. If you're writing about someone who is the same age, same gender, does the same kind of work, you know, tick off all those things that cause that kind of association, I would tell my students that there's a pretty good chance that you are going to need some distance from this character. And giving that character another name will be the first conscious act of that. Whereas if you're going to write about someone who is very different from you, if you're going to write about an 84-year-old nun, first person might be the way to go, because it will force an identification on you. It will bring you in closer to that person, which is often what you need. Now, this was just a rule of thumb for beginners, but it's often something that I will think about when I begin a story, trying to decide first person or third person. Just how close? What am I after here? Is this person? Lucy Lynch, take Lucy. I wanted him to be in first person. I thought he was very different from me. He is very stiff. He's very repressed. And I thought right from the beginning that I wanted to hear his voice. I wanted to hear him speaking to me kind of on his own. So that was an immediate choice. Somebody as repressed as Lucy is, and I'm not. I'm a lot of things, but I'm not terribly repressed. I thought it was going to be a challenge to get as close to him as I needed to, and I wanted him to speak to me in his own voice. And so I immediately, that was a very conscious choice. Bobby, on the other hand, I wanted a little distance from him because he was the boy who fled his hometown, as I did. He is the one who turned out to be an artist of some sort, as I am. He's the one who'd gotten famous, as I did. He is the one who has difficulty going back home, whereas Lucy has never left. There were a lot of points of identification with Noonan. So it was very important to him for me to give him a different name from me.
But to tie this dilemma into what you were telling me earlier about how you have to alter real life incidents sometimes to make them work in a novel, how much does that state of alteration relate to creating this sense of distance so that it is plausible? I mean, how much do you have to tinker? I mean, is there any difference if you are further or nearer to the particular character or what? What's the relationship between distance and the alteration of things that you have personally experienced?
I find it very difficult to tell literal truth about anything for very long without improving upon it. So I don't think, honestly, that whether I'm in first person or third person probably has an awful lot of effect on my need to improve upon life as I find it. And when I say improve upon it, that sometimes means telling lies about it. It also means sometimes subtraction. Often we think of imagination as inventing things, as adding things. Often I think imagination works by means of subtraction as well. There are all sorts of things that are related to the thing that you want to use, but you sense that it's not going to be particularly fruitful here, and so you take it out. The person that you're basing this story on in real life had a sister. We don't need the sister. We take her out. And so whether you're in first person or third person, for me at least, I don't think that has an enormous amount to do with how much you need to shift things around.
But I mean, looking back at all of your books, would you say that you cringe at the fact that you couldn't get this formula right in certain instances for some of your earlier books, perhaps, in terms of, you know?
Yeah, but I solved that problem by writing the next book.
Okay.
For instance, The Risk Pool is a father-son story told from the point of view of the son. And I love that novel, but about two-thirds of the way through it, I thought to myself, this is just... There's certain things about this father that I just cannot get at because of the point of view that I've chosen. I found that Sam Hall, as much as I loved him as a character, I found myself thinking to myself, boy, what would he have to say for himself, you know, if he could? And in that moment, Sully was born, and he was born from a different point of view. In some ways, Nobody's Fool is The Risk Pool written from the other character's point of view.
So as a result...
We changed the names and all of that. But
Which leads me to draw comparisons between the academic environment of Straight Man versus this one. You don't care about repeating yourself in a way. Repeating yourself allows you to revise the mistakes that you made before?
Oh, of course. Yeah. Of course.
Okay. So now we've got this.
Yeah. Of course. No, I don't. You don't want to. I think writers need to go back to certain kinds of territory. I've written now a couple of. For instance, I've written a couple of different things now. Monhegan Light was the first story that I wrote that allowed me to make use of my experiences as a screenwriter.
Yeah.
And now I've gone back to it here with this particular character. I think it may be a while before I go back to it again.
Yeah.
But I think I probably will, because I'm going to continue to learn things about that world that I didn't get in, or that I realize now that I got wrong. We'll fix that later in a new book.
We'll fix it in post. on that note.
That's right.
Yeah. Thanks very much, Rick. It was a pleasure chatting with you. Thanks for taking the time out.
I enjoyed it a lot. All right. As always.
Yeah.
That old black magic has me in its spell. That old black magic that you weave so well. I see fingers up and down my spine. Same old witchcraft when your eyes meet mine. The same old tingle that I feel inside. And then that elevator starts its ride.